none came. So I tried to make the most of it by resting and recovering my strength. At one point, I dug a little pit in the sand to shelter a fire, and then boiled water for tea. Rain fell, off and on, but with my knife I shaved off some dry kindling and kept the fire burning long enough for several cups of tea. I also decided to reduce the wind rushing under my tent. The noise it made was quite distracting, and I didn't much care for the sand sweeping into my tent either. To accomplish this, I stacked up some rocks to form a low wall around the edge of my tent fly facing the wind, which prevented gusts from sweeping underneath. The rock wall made it much quieter inside, and I slept better. In the cold and fierce wind, the surrounding barren mountains with their great ancient rock outcrops and the distant snows on the far side of the lake did begin to look a little more dismal and threatening. The skies were filled with dark, low-lying clouds that billowed by on the Arctic winds. But then weather can change the mood of any landscape. I hoped the winds would calm down in the evening. I was starting to feel distinctly anxious, knowing that I'd lost a full day and could ill afford to lose another. In the Arctic, the worst winds are generally in late summer, which in the past have stranded canoeing parties for weeks at a time. It was still only July, which didn't seem to bode well for what I might encounter come August. This was a drawback of solo paddling. One person in a canoe just can't battle winds as effectively as two or more can. In the old days of the fur trade and exploration, there was a reason why canoes typically had between 8 and 10 paddlers. The evening brought no respite from the stormy weather, and I huddled inside my tent, just hoping for a calm enough spell to set off. Shortly after 1 a.m., though, the howling of the wind subsided somewhat. When I went out to investigate, I was taken a little aback by the scene. Across the dark waters, the midnight sun, having dipped below the mountains, filled the cloudy sky with an eerie red glow. In the faint, unearthly light, the mountains stood dark and gloomy, with just patches of white snow standing out against the black slopes. I felt as though I were looking at some portal into another world. I'd never seen anything so hauntingly surreal. The wind was still sharp and cold, but the lake was calmer, with just small waves rippling across it. I decided to make a break for it. I rushed to get my sleeping bag and extra clothes packed up, the tent down, and my canoe flipped back over and launched into the lake. I packed the barrels in my backpack, zipped up my life jacket, pulled on the black balaclava and warm gloves, then pushed off, hopping into the canoe. I paddled hard away from the shore under dark skies into the wind, heading toward the eerie red glow of the horizon. The wind, however, proved fiercer out on the water than I had anticipated. My furious paddle strokes could barely edge the canoe forward. The wind kept driving me back toward the bleak shore. Try as I might, I couldn't overcome such strong gusts. All I was doing was exhausting myself for little gain. So, after only a kilometer and a half, I reluctantly put into shore on a gravelly beach. I realized I had no choice but to wait for the wind to die. In the meantime, I set up my tent on the gravel, leaving everything else ready to go at a moment's notice should the wind ease up. I slept some 3 or 4 hours, after which the wind didn't appear any better, but anxious as I was, I decided to attempt paddling against it anyway. The northern part of the Dismal Lakes is shaped like a giant T, or, as I thought of it at the time amid such wild and desolate scenery, like Thor's hammer. The bay I was trapped in formed the hammerhead, the part that looks like it's swinging downward. The fierce southwest wind was funneling through the mountains and right across the end of the hammer, which I'd been trying in vain to escape from. I figured if I could just overcome the wind long enough to get out of the hammerhead and around the point into the main section of the T, or handle, the wind shouldn't be as bad there. Tucked away in that narrow section of the lake, the wind wouldn't be hitting head-on as it was here, and the mountains would help shelter me. It was about 8 kilometers out of the bay I was trapped in, or 6.5 kilometers farther from where I'd stopped on the gravelly beach. All I had to do was paddle with all my strength for that long, and it seemed I should be all right. I put the tent away, did a few stretches to prepare myself, and then once more launched the canoe into the lake. Furiously, I paddled. It was some of the hardest, most exhausting paddling I've ever done. Bit by bit, stroke by stroke, I forced the canoe forward. I was glad I had my bent shaft paddle for the extra efficiency it gave each stroke. The wind was icy and steady, but regardless, I was soon sweating with exertion. There wasn't any chance to rest, for if I did, the wind would immediately drive me back down into the end of the bay. So I kept going. Finally, after several exhausting hours, I rounded the rocky wild shores into the main stem of the Dismal Lakes, the handle of Thor's hammer. Here the lake was only a bit more than a kilometer wide, and with the bleak, stony mountains on the far shore sheltering me from the wind's wrath, I could now paddle more easily, pushing on up the lake. The ice had melted here less than 2 weeks earlier. The Dismal Lakes tend to remain ice-covered right up until July. The scenery along the Dismal Lakes was wild, majestic, and awe-inspiring. It was true tundra, devoid of trees, with ancient mountains and rolling hills. There wasn't much wildlife about, but the scenery itself kept me enthralled as I paddled all day, not stopping until 7 that evening. I'd managed to advance 50 kilometers through the whole of the first Dismal Lake and then down through the narrows connecting it to the second of the three lakes. Amid this inconceivably ancient landscape, I pitched my tent on the tundra and gathered up just enough little willow branches for a fire in the shelter of some rocks. For as long as I was able, I intended to keep making fires in order to save my precious fuel canister. To travel light, I'd packed only a single mixed butane propane canister, which I'd need in places where there was scant wood to burn. The next day, I continued paddling through the lakes, feeling almost overwhelmed by the ancient landscape. Some of the world's oldest fossils, containing primitive life forms dating back over 1 billion years, have been discovered in the area around the Dismal Lakes by geologists. And to the south of these magical lakes, just east of Great Bear on the Canadian Shield, are possibly the oldest rocks ever discovered on the planet, dating back an astonishing 4 billion years to when the Earth was a lifeless wasteland. After passing through a weedy, sandy channel, I came to the last of the three Dismal Lakes. The wind was roaring as I reached it. This time, however, the wind was blowing in my favor, creating big waves rolling across the lake. It had been over a month since I'd used my sail. Not since the Mackenzie River had I had a chance to unfurl it. Poling and hauling up the smaller, rapid-filled rivers hadn't afforded any opportunities for it, and Great Bear Lake had been either too calm, too icy, or too dangerous for it. But now, conditions seemed ideal for me to test it out again. I pulled the knots holding the sail to my canoe's center thwart, and like an old friend it sprang up as if happy to see me, catching the wind. As it did, the canoe suddenly leapt forward, speeding ahead across the lake. With my straight shaft paddle, I steered over the big waves. After over a month of painstaking travel, I'd almost forgotten how exhilarating it felt to sail a canoe. We seemed to practically fly, and when the wind really gusted, the sail shook, then folded over almost double as the wind struck it forcefully. With breaking surf and the canoe flying along, I felt a little nervous, given the size of the waves. The cautious thing to do would probably have been not to sail in such high winds alone in a canoe. But I just couldn't resist the temptation. It felt incredible to move so fast, especially after such wearisome portaging and stiff headwinds. The canoe's speed I estimated at over 10 kilometers an hour, based on clocking time on my watch and measuring it against distances along the lake. In less than 30 minutes, I'd crossed the last of the Dismal Lakes. Draining the Dismal Lakes is the Kendall River, a fast-flowing, rapid-filled stream of about 30 kilometers length that empties into the Coppermine River, which in turn flows out to the Arctic Ocean. Once I'd reached the river's outlet from the lake, I quickly reefed my sail and switch back to paddling. Seeing how it was the first significant water I'd paddled on since my trek began where the current was actually in my favor, it felt almost like a holiday to travel without having to wade, haul, drag, and pull against a current. The river was full of small rock-strewn rapids, which I plunged through in the canoe, dodging the rocks and enjoying the speed of the current. Most of these rapids would have been easy to navigate were it not for the same strong winds that had driven me across the lake. The wind, in places where the river curved, now hit me broadside, which made steering the canoe trickier than normal. Still, my progress was swift, and I soon reached a canyon that marked the end of the short river. This high-walled, red limestone canyon had some bigger rapids inside of it, one of which saw fit to fling my canoe at the canyon wall after I'd plunged through its foaming water. Fortunately, with my paddle, I was able to brace myself from slamming into the cliffs and continue downstream. By evening, I'd made it through the whole of the Kendall River and reached its outlet into a far larger, more powerful river, one steeped in history and fable, where 500 million years ago, volcanoes roared over the land, the copper mine. No aspect of my journey across the Arctic was more fraught with danger, uncertainty, and hardship than what this storied river promised to unleash upon me. Somehow, against all conventional logic, I had to find a way to canoe the Coppermine River in reverse, a river whose current made the Mackenzies seem tame in comparison. Its formidable, roaring current, packed as it was with thunderous whitewater rapids, treacherous cliffs, and deep canyons, I knew would take everything I had. Chapter 12, The Serpent's Coil. Back on those acid rain-scarred hills above Sudbury, I'd visualized my entire route, brooding over its every aspect, and how best to approach its various obstacles. I'd come up with different stratagems for different sections, planning everything as carefully as I could. But there was one section of my route that always filled me with doubt. That was the Coppermine River. If trying to canoe up the Mackenzie alone was regarded as absurd by experienced canoeists, trying to canoe the Coppermine in reverse, a river whose current was perhaps 3 times stronger than even the Mackenzie's, was seen by veteran northern travelers as utterly delusional, if not a case of actual self-harm. The river's torturous course was filled with innumerable obstacles, thundering whitewater rapids, sheer cliffs, canyons, and a powerful, rip-roaring current that extended for hundreds of kilometers. My task was to figure out a way to navigate my canoe upriver, against the fearsome current and foaming rapids, with what amounted to about 120 pounds of gear and provision inside the canoe, slowing it down. In 1770, when the explorer Samuel Hearne and renowned Chippewyan leader Matonabbee reached the river's rugged valley, seeing the falls, canyons, and rapids, they at once deemed it unnavigable for birch bark canoes, instead opting to travel on foot. They were smart like that. Where I came upon the Coppermine River, it was certainly an impressive sight, a noisy, fast-flowing waterway over 0.5 kilometer wide. To the north were strange-looking mountains formed of long slabs of stacked pinkish rock, which looked vaguely like the Egyptian step pyramid of Djoser. They'd been formed by ancient lava flows piling up one on top of the other hundreds of millions of years ago. In the middle of the river lay a couple of big, flat, meadow-like islands sprinkled with bright clusters of purplish-pink fireweed and yellow cinquefoil. I paddled a short distance against the current to land on the nearer of these islands. By now it was late evening, and a light rain had begun to fall. So I made camp and gathered driftwood for a fire. I needed a good night's sleep to prepare for what promised to be a grueling, exhausting upriver battle that would exceed anything I'd yet attempted. Lying in my tent, listening to the noise of the nearby river, I thought over what I had to do if I were to succeed in getting up the Coppermine. Against a current that powerful, brute strength would count for little. My only chance was to rely on agility, careful decision-making, and above all, determination. Now more than ever, the idea of the tortoise racing the hare was my guiding philosophy. Only with a great deal of patience and persistence could I overcome the river's seemingly impossible current. I got an early start in the morning, packing my canoe with a sense of dread as I listened to the rumble and roar of distant rapids. There was no kidding myself. I was in for the challenge of my life. I began by paddling away from the island, against the current, over to the river's western bank. It was strewn with rocks and steep slopes, not at all ideal for wading and hauling. Worse yet, my wading boots were starting to fall apart, the left one having been ripped open on some sharp underwater rocks. The waders themselves had several punctures in them. I'd become used to wet feet, but it wasn't great for the agility needed for scrambling about on rocks. With my hip waders on, I began wading while pulling the canoe behind me. This kind of wading is typically shunned by canoeists because it's dangerous. As the wise Bill Mason put it, when wading, if you jam your foot between rocks when in waist-deep water, and if you fell downstream, the current could hold you from getting back up without help. That's probably why wading alone on Arctic rivers isn't often encouraged. In 1979, the federal government published a manual for canoeists seeking to paddle barrenland rivers in the Canadian North. In the chapter on the copper mine, a helpful warning was included in bold type. The copper mine is a river that should be attempted only by canoeists experienced in white water. The region is totally isolated. The water is fast and cold, and serious mistakes can be fatal. Canoeing parties of 6 to 12 are the norm for safety, and some northern outfitters refuse to rent canoes or equipment to parties of less than 4, on the grounds anything smaller is reckless. Even traveling in a group of 2 in a single canoe, as Chuck and I did, and as my friend Travis and I were also in the habit of doing, is seen by many northern canoeists as risky. As for traveling upriver, alone, that was simply not done. I thought back to the days I'd spent poling up the Mackenzie, and how, in comparison, that now seemed almost easy. Here the current was too powerful even for poling, let alone wading and dragging the canoe like I'd done on other rivers. My only options were either to hike along the shore with a rope pulling the canoe in the water, or else to keep one foot on dry land and the other on the water's edge, grasping the canoe's bow directly in my hands and hauling it upriver that way. The shoreline was steeply sloped, with jumbles of skull-sized rocks that were easy to trip over, especially when having to keep an eye on the canoe as I either hauled it with rope or else directly with my hand on the bow. It proved hard, difficult work, but I kept at it, putting one foot in front of the other, choosing my spots among the rocks with care. In some places, where the river ran over shallower stretches, I had to climb down into the water to pull the canoe forward. It was a sunny day, and the glare off the fast-flowing water, coupled with the mesh bug net I wore, limited my vision. The clouds of black flies were extreme, attacking any flesh they could get at. Before long, I came to a large, roaring rapid that I had to very carefully line my canoe up with rope. Lining, also called tracking, is a delicate business. It consists of guiding your canoe up rapids with a rope while standing on shore. I've been doing it for 13 years and, fortunately, had never had a mishap. But there's little margin for error. If the canoe catches the current wrong, it can take only seconds for it to tip, fill with water, and get swept away. Truly, there's something very unsettling about watching your canoe, loaded with all your essentials, including emergency means of communication, out in the swirling, turbulent waters tethered to yourself with just a thin rope. As such, I only use this method when I have little choice, which on the copper mine looked like it was going to be most of the time. Hours pass without much progress. The current remained rip-roaring, with dangerous eddies, whirlpools, and rapids nearly everywhere I looked. The steeply sloped shoreline, filled with rocks perfect for twisting an ankle on, further complicated things. Whenever conditions were slightly less daunting, I tried to hike as fast as I could, as I was ever conscious that time was ticking on my journey, and that at the rate I was going, I'd still be stuck on the copper mine when the snows of September came. After about 5 kilometers of difficult wading and lining, the river began to rapidly narrow, forcing all that roaring water into a channel less than 200 meters wide. This increased the current's velocity as a result. Now the river was racing past at a terrifying speed. I soon came to large boulders on shore, which ran straight down into the river, forming small cliffs. Given the boulders, I couldn't continue hiking while pulling the canoe in the water beside me. Nor could I avoid the boulders by wading. The river was too deep for that. I'd have to climb over the boulders, while letting out rope to guide the canoe in the water around them. I took a moment to visualize things. I had to be sure. There was definitely no margin for error here. I coiled up the rope in my right hand, pulling the canoe in a back eddy close to shore, where it could rest for a moment out of the main current. Ahead were the giant boulders. First, I'd have to climb them. Then I'd carefully tug the canoe out into the river, before pulling in the rope to advance the canoe up the current. Then I'd skip to the next boulder, keeping ahead of the boat, and repeat the maneuver. It was important to move fast so that I'd stay ahead of the canoe to control it. If I let it get too far from shore, or if I wasn't precise with the rope, it could catch the current, pull sideways, and overturn, leaving me stranded. My palms were sweating as I executed my moves, scampering ahead as agilely as I could in ungainly waders, climbing from boulder to boulder, reeling the canoe up almost parallel to me, darting ahead again. To ease the tension, I talked a little to the canoe as I went, reassuring it, telling it that I'd reel it back in safely. So far, so good. Then high red cliffs loomed up ahead, running straight down into the river and blocking the way forward. I pulled the canoe into a low spot on shore before the cliffs, securing it there. I'd have to go ahead on foot to scout out how to get around these cliffs. It was dicey work, edging up the cliffs, climbing carefully over steep rocks. One slip, and I could fall into the river below or bash my head on a rock. I was thankful for all the indoor rock climbing I'd done. The training helped me move with more confidence. After scouting things out, it seemed it was possible to line around the cliff if I was careful. I returned to the canoe, towing it into a calm spot just below the start of the cliff. It could rest there while I climbed as far ahead as I could, leaving just a bit of slack rope. Once up on the cliff, I stood near the edge and looked back at my little canoe bobbing in the turbulent river below as waves rippled out to the rocky shoreline from the rapids in the middle. "All right," I said to myself, "here it goes." I tugged gently on the rope, nudging the canoe's bow away from the calm water and into the main current. The current caught it, but I moved rapidly to reel it in, pulling fast to safely control the canoe and bring it alongside the cliff. When I'd coiled in almost all the slack rope, I darted ahead along the cliff, keeping the rope tense to hold the canoe steady in the current. Next, I climbed down to a steep, cobble-strewn bank where I could reel in the canoe the rest of the way, along the edge of the rock wall. A few more pulls brought the canoe safely up alongside me. I breathed a sigh of relief to have the canoe in my hands again. This feeling proved short-lived. Just a short distance ahead, I came to more cliffs, only these were much larger, again rising straight out of the water. They were far too big for me to climb. My rope wasn't nearly long enough, and even if I had more rope, it would be too risky to chance tracking a canoe from such a height. I looked around, trying to figure out what to do. Clearly, I couldn't go over the cliffs, nor could I pull or paddle ahead. The fast-flowing river was too powerful. I thought of portaging, but even that seemed doubtful, as the rocky cliff promised to be difficult to get around. And even if I did succeed in getting around this cliff, what if there were more ahead? I couldn't see beyond these cliffs, but from what I'd so far encountered, this side of the river seemed like it was going to have a lot more cliffs, and the contour lines on my maps weren't encouraging. I looked across the surging water to the far bank. That side of the river had steep slopes filled with rocks of the sort I'd been hiking along before coming to the big boulders and cliffs on this side. But there weren't any cliffs that I could see on that side. If I could get across to it, I might have more luck there. I decided to try crossing the river. It wouldn't be easy. The current's velocity here was tremendous, ripping by at great speed. Downriver was a big rapid, which I lined up along the shore, and I didn't want to be swept down into it. I could probably run it if I had to, but that meant getting spit out far downriver, causing me to lose precious, hard-won progress. Covering just 5 kilometers had taken me nearly 3 hours. To ferry across the river, against the current to the far side, would require some careful maneuvering and hard paddling. I coiled up the rope, stashed it in the bow, then fetched my straight shaft paddle, which I needed for the greater control it would allow me in the current. To get across, I'd essentially have to paddle upriver, which would put me in a sort of treadmill on the current, but in the process that would allow me to shift the canoe across sideways without yielding distance. I braced the canoe along shore, took a last glance at the river above and below, then hopped in and shoved off. On my knees, I paddled hard upriver. Fortunately, the current wasn't as strong near the shore, and I shot ahead a bit before catching the main force of the water. This pushed me back a little, but hard strokes held me steady in the current. I began to edge across, paddling as if trying to go upriver, but angling my canoe slightly to ferry or shuffle it across. The whole operation went quite fast, and I landed on the opposite rocky bank, more or less where I intended. This side of the river was cliff-free, but still a challenge to make headway on. The current remained fierce, and the jumble of small rocks everywhere on the sloping banks made walking tricky, as I could lose my footing just about anywhere. Slow and steady, I told myself, and kept going. Hours of hard effort later, I came to a place where the river widened, forking around a couple of low gravel islands before curving sharply out of view. The near side of the islands was easily navigated. The water was shallow and the current less strong, allowing me to wade. Beyond these islands, I encountered a spectacular sight, a towering, steep-walled canyon through which the river roared. Securing my canoe on shore, I went ahead on foot to scout it out. There was a small beach just below the stupendous cliffs that marked the canyon's entrance, or rather the end of it, as it only seemed like the entrance to me since I was traveling upriver. The canyon walls towered some 60 meters high. Along the cliff edge grew spruces and willows, while inside the narrow walls swirled massive rapids and dangerous whirlpools. From a theoretical point of view, the canyon was beautiful. From a practical point of view, it was a nightmare. How was I to get up it? It seemed unlikely that I'd be able to continue through the canyon, but anything that might reduce portaging was worth investigating. I began by climbing up the rocks near the canyon's start, picking my way carefully up to a rugged peak. These rocks weren't part of the main canyon, but rather formed a sort of spur or peninsula that jutted out into the river. Here the river narrowed to about 50 meters, with furious white water roaring in the main channel. But on the inside of the rocky spur I'd climbed, there was a little tranquil cove. However, from atop the rocks, I could see that the canyon walls rose much higher farther up, the whole force of the river squeezing through it and forming violent rapids. I climbed down to the cove and then moved up the shoreline, deeper into the shadows of the canyon, until I came to vertical walls that prevented me from advancing any farther along the water. Between these vertical cliffs was a narrow slope, a sort of rock and gravel slide with some willow bushes where I could climb up. Huffing and puffing, I scrambled my way up the cliff here to the canyon's rim. When I reached the top and stood up to look around, my eyes met with an unexpected sight. A large stone monument about 6 feet high perched near the cliff edge. After months traveling alone in the wilderness, stumbling across human-made objects felt a bit startling. Accustomed as I'd grown to uninterrupted rocks, trees, tundra, plants, or water. I walked around the monument and saw on its face a finely cut stone inscription above a concrete base. It read, "David and Carol Jones, who loved the North and its people, were drowned in these rapids on August 14, 1972. They respected honesty and truth." This inscription discouraged me a little. I took a few steps away from it over to the cliff edge and looked down 200 feet at the swirling, thundering water below. That didn't seem very encouraging either, so I turned back from the edge. Beside the monument was a faint trail. This must be, I realized, from parties of canoeists coming downriver when they portage around the canyon. The copper mine, due to its wild rapids, attracts parties of whitewater paddling enthusiasts willing to pay the hefty fees for an air charter by float plane to get dropped off on the river. Such canoeists can paddle down with the current, usually taking 2 or 3 weeks, then fly out again at the river's mouth. Since I was here at just about the right time, midsummer, this part of my route offered me my best chance of crossing paths with fellow canoe campers, something I hadn't seen any of since my journey began, thousands of kilometers away in the Yukon. I followed the trail in the direction I'd come, until it petered out and I picked my own way down a rocky hill and over some willows to where I'd left my canoe and gear. "Well," I said to the canoe, "there is no way we can make it up that canyon. We'll have to portage, but don't worry, there's a bit of a trail we can follow." I strapped on my backpack, took some water, then set off. The portage, it turned out, was about 0.5 kilometer long, snaking up over the cliffs and along the canyon edge. The trail was distinct along the top part, but toward the end faded away on the rocks, and I found my own way back down a steep, rock-strewn slope to the river's edge. When I reached the monument, I paused for a moment's silence. 4 more trips back and forth were required to transport my 2 barrels and the canoe, which I carried over my head, as I didn't wish to drag it on the rocks and hard ground. However, when I reached the top, near the canyon's rim, I set the canoe down. Instead of carrying it here, I dragged it through the willows, knowing that if I tripped on a rock or if the wind were to gust and knock me off balance, I'd topple 200 feet into the river below. The sunny weather seemed to make the black flies particularly vicious while my hands were full with the canoe. Once I'd transported everything across, I carefully repacked the canoe alongside the river and then edged it out into the water, which was still swirling along with tremendous velocity. Glancing at the narrow entrance to the canyon, I thought how bad it would be for a canoeist coming downriver who failed to stop and was sucked into the canyon, not having realized the danger. I wondered if that's what had happened to David and Carol Jones. With the canoe ready, I turned away from the canyon and began slogging ahead on foot once more, pulling the canoe beside me. The portage meant a lengthy delay, and my heart sank at how little progress I'd so far made upriver. The banks remained steeply sloped and difficult to walk along without twisting an ankle, due to the piles of rocks everywhere. I was feeling exhausted and a little discouraged, but I forced myself to keep going. It was late in the day, and suitable campsites were few and far between. The river's steep banks, beyond which were high hills, meant a lack of level ground anywhere to sleep on. I pushed on, inching forward step by step, hauling the canoe against the powerful current. In vain I looked for any flat ground to sleep on. At last, wearied and hungry, I settled for a tiny, partially sloped bit of gravel beneath high, steep banks near the water's edge. It wasn't by any means a nice place to sleep, but I was too exhausted to much mind. Inside my tent, I studied my maps. With despair, I calculated that, despite having put in 11 hours of my hardest efforts, I'd made it just 12 kilometers upriver. Such pitiful progress was demoralizing. At no point on my journey had I felt so low. Even my worst days on the Mackenzie, I'd still done 20 kilometers, and that was over a shorter day. At this rate, I knew I'd never complete my journey. Difficult as it was, I had to dispel these doubts and try to encourage myself for what tomorrow would hold, another brutally hard day of upriver travel in which somehow I'd have to do better. Lying in my tent on the cold, hard ground, I tried to prepare myself for the morning. I consoled myself with the thought that, on balance, I was probably doing what I love most. Chapter 13. Gifts from Above. The next morning I was underway early, hauling my canoe upriver while hopping along the rocks beside it. Then came more rapids, which required a combination of strenuous effort and careful precision to overcome, as I knew all too well what might happen if I slipped in the current and fell over, or lodged my foot in an unseen crevice beneath the water, twisting an ankle. As I pushed on, sections of the river improved greatly, widening enough so that I could actually stand in the canoe and pole off the bottom near shore. To switch back to poling was a great relief. I made the most of it, poling as hard as I possibly could. Some of the smaller rapids, or swifts, I even managed to pole up by sticking close to the high banks and choosing my spots just right. At the edge of the rapids were often large gray boulders sticking up like the back of a hippopotamus, which created a calm spot directly behind by diverting water. As I approached these, I'd spring off the bottom with my pole, and once behind them, hop out onto the boulder, pull the canoe around it, and then jump back in on the far side, poling ahead to the calmer water. In some of the smaller swifts, however, I found that with great effort I could fling myself out from behind the boulder with the pole into the main current, and poling hard, make it up through the swifts. Once or twice, though, the current proved too strong when I tried, spinning the canoe around and forcing it downriver. I'd have to steer back into shore and try again, this time reverting to my safer hopping out on the boulder approach. In a few sections, the river widened enough that I could actually paddle, as long as I kept close to shore and out of the reach of the main current. And in places where high slope banks towered above me, I could jab at them with my pole, propelling myself along. This was even faster than poling through the water, but it only worked in places with the right steep banks for it. Finally, in a precious few spots few and far between, but encouraging all the same, the surging current would create back eddies close to the high banks, where the water rushed back upstream. When I caught these currents, the canoe would seem to fly along, cheering my spirits, though they lasted only a few seconds. Mostly, however, I had to haul the canoe as I waded through the rushing water. When I halted after 12 hours' travel to make camp, I found my progress had much improved. I managed to make it 25 kilometers. Still, I didn't want to get overconfident. My route entailed traveling some 200 kilometers upriver on the Coppermine before I could cross into the lakes of the Central Arctic, so there was still a long way to go. My third day battling up the Coppermine, I navigated more difficult rapids, but my dread of them faded as I rounded a sharp bend and came to a place where the river widened and the current slackened. A great rugged range of hills, or more accurately, small mountains, rose up on the eastern side of the river in successive waves, stretching beyond the horizon. Along their lower slopes grew black spruce, which survive along sheltered river valleys, though a short distance beyond them the trees give way to vast open plains of seemingly limitless extent. I was happy to see this wide bit of river, not only because it meant an easier current, but because it was the spot I'd selected, based on satellite imagery, for my next resupply. There are few places on the Coppermine River where a float plane can safely land, given the rocks and rapids, but this wide part, with its more subdued current, was one of them. I paddled up the middle of it, checking the water levels and looking for any hidden shoals that could cause trouble for a plane. Having pushed myself as hard as I could, I'd again exceeded my estimates, and it had taken me only 2 weeks to arrive here from the end of Great Bear instead of the 3 I had to cautiously figure on. It was with economy in mind, and the need to minimize the amount of heavy food rations that I was carrying during such arduous upriver travel and portaging, that I'd resolved for a resupply at this point. That wasn't all. To save money and cut down on the weight of my loads up the remainder of the Coppermine, I'd decided on a gamble. The pilot was going to give me only half my rations, keeping the other half with him on the plane. On his return to Yellowknife, he would land on a lake to leave the rest of the supplies for me inside a wooden crate. There was a chance, of course, that a wolverine or grizzly might find the crate and break it open for the rations, but that's why I'd asked for it to be put on a remote island far offshore. It was a risk, but knowing what I did of the copper mine, and what I'd seen so far of it, the prospect of allowing me to travel lighter up the remainder of it, since I wouldn't have to haul all the extra supplies with me, was worth taking. Once I'd found a suitable spot with deep, unobstructed water where the plane could land, I made camp. Since I'd be expecting visitors, I figured I'd ought to try something I hadn't done in weeks, what's known as bathing. Bracing myself, I took a swim in the river's frigid waters. It felt chilling, but refreshing all the same, aside from the black flies swarming my head. Afterward, I unpacked the satellite phone from its waterproof case and called the pilot in distant Yellowknife to confirm the resupply. When I got through to the pilot, over the staticky line, I also asked a favor. My waders had become hopelessly punctured from bumping against sharp rocks while wading upriver, and I asked if he could get me a new pair from the store. The cheapest ones would do, I said, as I was still on a budget. Luckily, the pilot indicated that conditions on the radar looked decent enough for him to attempt the flight early the next morning. It would be a long flight for a little single-engine bush plane to make, about 1,000-kilometer round trip over uninhabited forests and Arctic tundra. In the meantime, while Arctic terns soared gracefully over the river, I sorted through my gear. The long portages and strenuous upriver travel had made me obsess over ways to travel lighter by eliminating anything I could. The canoe cart, which hadn't been effective and had been a pain to lug all this way, would definitely be a gift for the pilot. Also included on the to-go list were my trekking poles, which I hadn't used since the Dempster, the ripped hip waders, I'd be getting a new pair in my resupply barrel, as well as the chest waders, which I'd worn only once and figured I could do without, the broken water purifier, I hadn't gotten sick at all and no longer had any worry on that account, a harness with ropes that I'd also worn only once on the Mackenzie while walking on shore. It didn't weigh much, but I figured that the improvised harness I made out of ordinary rope was good enough, as well as small miscellaneous items such as carabiners and dead batteries. On the flip side, I'd have additional weight coming in from the new waders, as well as several canisters of camp stove fuel that I'd included in my next resupply barrel. Wood was becoming scarce, and especially on the tundra during storms, it would be nice to be able to boil water beside my tent to warm up. The morning dawned cold and rainy, delaying the flight in. Finally, by noon I heard the drone of an engine, and then out of the overcast sky a plane materialized, looking in my imagination like a machine from another world. The little float plane sliced through the gray clouds and flew in low over the wide stretch of river. Twice the pilot circled, scouting out the water below before attempting a landing. I'd verified from my canoe that there were no rocks, but one can't be too careful when landing planes on isolated northern rivers. Finally, the pilot executed a perfect landing, skimming along the water on the plane's pontoons. I'd never met this pilot before. I'd been communicating only with his boss beforehand down in Yellowknife. A young man of about my age emerged from the cockpit, jumping down on the plane's left pontoon and waving to me. I waved back. It seemed the appropriate thing to do. With him were two passengers, Francis and Pablo, who'd come along for the ride. These were the first people I'd seen since my brief interaction with the two fishing guides on Great Bear, who in turn were the only humans I'd seen over the last 41 days since my brief stop in Fort Good Hope. The pilot, whose name was Michael, handed me the barrel I'd carefully packed before the journey. As before, I emptied it into my existing barrel, then handed it back to him. Only this time I left half of the supplies in it. He also handed me the new hip waders. Then we discussed the logistics of where he'd leave the food drop for me on an island. It was impossible to say precisely. Bushplane flying has its own set of rules, and he couldn't know in advance where it would be safe to land. Water levels shift frequently, exposing rocks, but we'd agreed on an approximate location. Francis, who'd seen me set off on the Dempster, said he'd never fully realized the vastness of the land until he saw it from high above in a tiny bush plane. Flying for hours, they'd pass no signs of any human-made object below, just thousands of lakes, rivers, ponds, and mountains appearing to go on forever in all directions. I was anxious to get on my way, regretting the time I'd already lost that morning, and again I felt a little overwhelmed with socializing, especially compared to the relaxing simplicity of navigating canoes up whitewater rivers. When everything was settled, the plane's engines roared back to life. They waved goodbye and I was already off. The day was getting on, after all. I listened to the float plane as it faded away into silence, leaving me with just the sounds of water swirling from my paddle strokes as I headed upriver, enjoying the slacker current and the sight of wild mountains framing the land. That night I camped on an overgrown island on a small hill in the rain. Lying outstretched in my tent, a mattress of soft moss and lichens beneath me, I felt content and even serene, feeling like I'd overcome the worst of the copper mine. For nearly a week, the weather stayed cold and rainy. Meanwhile, the river's character changed dramatically as I continued my upriver journey. It widened out to more than a kilometer across in marshy lowlands surrounded by mist-shrouded mountains. They were great green crags with dark, rocky summits that in the fog and rain appeared gloomy and forlorn, much like the Scottish Highlands. Or, at least, much like what I imagine the Scottish Highlands look like. The river's current had slackened such that I was actually paddling my canoe upriver most of the time, alternating with poling in stretches where it narrowed. My days were long, but with the wind occasionally in my favor, I even managed to sail a little. I was now averaging about 40 kilometers a day, and it was always with a feeling of contentment that at the end of a long, tiring day, wet from the rain, I'd climb into my tent to get warm. The weather didn't bother me too much. I was able to scrounge up enough wood to keep making fires, and there was something about the rain and wild, romantic scenery that helped lull me into daydreams as I paddled. This whole section of the river had a lazy, dreamlike air to it, with its fog and mountains, and its marshy shorelines of sedges and willows. It was a welcome change from the fury and roar of where I'd first entered the copper mine. The more subdued river brought a return to wildlife. Robins, bald eagles, terns, swans, loons, sandpipers, ducks of various kinds, including ones I hadn't seen before, and even a beautiful little red-colored pine grosbeak. Muskrats were also about. Caribou and white wolves wandered the riverbanks. I startled a big bull moose that was busy munching on some weeds in the water. In response, he startled me too. In a wider, more tranquil stretch that I could paddle, the sight of a white wolf along the bank stirred my sense of awe. The wolf was more timid than others I'd seen, but still very curious as it watched me paddling along. The only wildlife that wasn't very friendly were the nesting Arctic terns. These elegant birds make their annual migrations from the Arctic all the way to Antarctica, the longest migration of any animal on the planet. I'd always admired the terns' beauty and amazing flying abilities, though I was rather less enthusiastic about their insistence on trying to dive bomb me with their razor-sharp beaks as I navigated upriver. Paddling downriver, I could travel fast enough to escape from their aerial assaults, but going upriver is another story, and I found myself repeatedly experiencing the sensation that Alfred Hitchcock's film The Birds had been adapted to 3D. To protect myself, I had to switch from my broad-brimmed hat into my helmet, which I'd actually only packed for running whitewater rapids later in the trip, not bird attacks. On July 24th, while making camp in a marshy area, I found my first ripe blueberries. They were a bit tart, but I regarded such a find as a great treasure, and I eagerly looked forward to more becoming ripe soon, as well as all the other berries that I'd been eyeing for weeks with anticipation. One decidedly unexpected thing was what I uncovered one night in the crooked branch of an ancient, twisted black spruce near my camp, the white feathered claw of a small animal. Evidently, it had been severed from its body, for there was no sign of the rest of the creature. Turning it over in my hand, I realized it was the talon of a snowy owl. What could have killed it? Owls are sometimes hunted and killed by foxes, as well as by lynx, which pounce on them unseen, It seemed likely that this particular owl had fallen victim to one or the other. Its talon and some feathers were all that was left of it. For a while, I thought of keeping it as a good luck charm, like a white rabbit's foot. But then it occurred to me that an owl that had been killed in such a manner probably wasn't very lucky. So I tossed it away. After 5 days of relatively pleasant travel, conditions became more difficult. I awoke the morning of July 26 to find frost blanketing the ground. And just as the weather had turned cold, the copper mine turned rough again, with swift currents and huge rapids. That frosty morning, I was frequently reduced to painstaking waiting, harder than anything I'd yet experienced. My feet took a beating among the sharp, jagged rocks along the river bottom in those spots where I had to wade almost up to my waist against the powerful current. In most places, though, the shoreline was a chaotic jumble of rocks and boulders, such that I could usually, holding on to the canoe's bow for balance, half wade and half jump along these rocks to make progress. The chilly morning turned into a cold day. At one point, I stumbled in the current, allowing waves to come over my hip waders, flooding them. I inhaled at the shock of the cold. Then I pulled my canoe into shore, climbed up onto a flat rock, and emptied the waders. My pants and socks were drenched, but there wasn't time to dry things out. I just wrung out the socks, put them back on, and kept going. Discouraging as having your waders flood with frigid waters can be, I always found that there was some little thing to cheer me up. The sight of robins hopping along the banks, or a lone wolf wandering the shoreline, or an eagle soaring overhead. Sometimes it's the little things that make all the difference. Since wading was proving increasingly punishing on my shins and feet, I tried to line or track the canoe with rope wherever possible. In a few stretches, the bank, with its low boulders, wasn't too difficult. I could jump from one to another with relative ease. My progress was pretty good. Then, up ahead, I saw a couple of big rocks extending from shore out into the turbulent water. These kind of rocks always made me a little nervous, as they are often the hardest and most dangerous to navigate around. Still, it looked possible. So, with the canoe in the water and me on shore holding it with rope, I went beyond where the two rocks protruded from the river. Then, I began to pull the canoe upstream toward me. I had to extend my right arm out from shore, tugging the canoe so it would nudge around the boulders. But the canoe's bow edged just an inch too far, catching the current on its side. Fear shot through me. The force of the water began to tip the canoe as it pivoted sideways in the current. Water began lapping in. I had only seconds to act. If the canoe flooded, it would be swept downriver through the rapids and lost. I had to do the opposite of what instinct suggested. Instead of holding on tightly, my only option was to ease up, letting the rope go slack in my hand. Doing so allowed the half-flooded canoe to right itself as it spun back to a straight position out of the rapid. Then, I dashed downstream, pulling it in toward a tranquil pool where I could safely haul it ashore. My heart was pounding. Had I reacted a second slower, my canoe would have been lost, the current's force carrying it and all my gear far away downstream. I stepped into the water beside the canoe and began to unload it on the bank. I had to empty the water out of it before I could continue. I wasn't going to risk a second attempt lining with rope around the rocks. Instead, I portaged. After such a close shave, my reaction is generally to get back in the saddle as fast as possible. Dwelling on what might have been, I don't think is helpful, but pushing on helps restore confidence. So, once I'd portaged around the boulders, I was back to tracking the canoe with the rope along the shore and in some places waiting, as the swift current continued for miles. Then I came across something else on shore, a destroyed canoe. It was an old aluminum boat, apparently crushed and mangled by the rapids when it had pinned on a rock, the force of the current folding it in half. Evidently, whomever had been paddling it never made it downriver, at least not in that canoe. It looked several decades old, at least, and was a reminder of what a single mistake in powerful rapids can do. That afternoon, after hauling, wading, and lining up a succession of large-scale rapids alternating with calmer sections, I came to the wildest rapid I'd ever seen, a tremendous, roaring affair over a kilometer wide. Normally, rapids occur in narrow sections of river, so such a wide, tumbling rapid that went on for as far as I could make out upriver was an impressive sight, and also a little demoralizing. Beneath this massive cataract of rushing water and boulders was a wide, calm stretch, allowing me to paddle in toward the start of it. I canoed towards its roaring fury, trying to determine if one side might be better than the other to struggle up it. Neither looked promising, but I opted for the left. It took all my reserves of willpower and strength to get the canoe up this great rapid, wading, hauling, dashing between rocks, doing everything I could to overcome the current. Then, amid the endless sharp rocks, my new waders, fresh in from the resupply, punctured. The frigid waters of the copper mine flooded right into my boot. There was nothing to be done about it. I had to push on for another 2 hours before I could call it a night and make camp. Once I had the tent up and a fire going, my priority was to repair the wader. From the bark of a nearby black spruce, I gathered some sap, or spruce gum. The sticky resin I heated on a rock in my fire until it melted to a honey-like consistency. Then, with a stick as a ladle, I applied it to the small puncture in my wader. Over top the pitch, I laid down some tape. The tape on its own won't stay, even when you heat it beforehand. This done, the waders were as good as new. I just had to hope they didn't puncture again, as I knew the spruces were thinning out, and that soon there'd be none at all. My belief that I'd overcome the worst of the Coppermine's rapids proved a bit optimistic. It took another 2.5 days of grueling travel to battle my way through endless swifts and many more large rapids, some of them as much as class 4 or 5 on the paddler's difficulty scale. In the midst of one fast section of river with high sandy banks, I was standing in the canoe poling along when I looked up and suddenly saw other canoes coming downriver. At last, in 2 months of traveling, these were the first other campers I'd encountered. To my eyes, there seemed to be an unbelievable multitude of them, fully 8 people. It was the biggest crowd I'd seen in months. They were men in their early or mid-20s, divided between 4 canoes, each of them wearing a helmet. The current was strong, with swirls and eddies everywhere, and it was carrying them along at a fast pace. The sight of me, long-haired, heavily bearded, standing upright in a canoe while poling off the river bottom, seemed to surprise them. They stared at me in apparent bewilderment as they drifted rapidly by on the current. At last, when they were almost past, one of the 8 in the rear canoe mustered a shouted hello. I responded with, "Hi," as I jabbed my long pole through the rushing waters, driving the canoe forward. As quickly as they'd come, the river carried them out of sight, and I saw no more of them. I supposed it would only be logical for them to have assumed I was some sort of crazy hermit of the kind that's best prudently avoided, as doubtless they thought, as everyone I'd spoken to about the matter beforehand had, that traveling upriver on the copper mine was an act of insanity. Or perhaps they figured I was only poling upriver a short distance for some odd reason, and would soon set aside the pole and follow after them. In any case, I kept going upriver. Fortunately, after passing another roaring rapid, I came to a short stretch that was a bit less fierce, and here I met a friendlier group of river travelers, a family of 7 Canada geese. 5 goslings followed their watchful parents, paddling along near the grassy shoreline, the little ones seeming to regard me with curiosity. They were a much more communicative bunch, honking at me cheerfully. The geese come here to raise their young. Then by late August, once the goslings are big enough to fly, they make their own great journeys south to warmer climes. The following day, I wearily continued upriver. After some 11 hours of exhausting travel, I stopped and made camp at a narrow section where a massive rapid thundered ferociously. I camped by the rapid, though the blackflies were atrocious, on account of the fact I was just too tired to press on farther. I'd made it 28 kilometers upriver during the day, and there was now a decent crop of ripened blueberries for me to feast on. With July nearing its close, the bugs were worse than ever. Each night, Inside my tent, I performed a little ritual. It consisted of killing every last black fly that had made its way in. No matter what I tried, wiping them off, standing near the suffocating smoke of my fire, about 100 of them managed to get inside during the seconds it took me to unzip and re-zip the tent door. Not only were there always intense swarms of them outside my tent, but many would also be hidden in my clothing, hair, beard, and anywhere else they could get at. There is nothing worse than black flies buzzing around inside your tent at the end of a long, hard day. Fortunately, they tend to fly up to the top, where they can be easily squished against the ceiling. My once beautiful tent had become utterly streaked with bloodstains from squishing bugs. Lying inside my tent, the midsummer Arctic sun still shining, I cast a glance out the screen door at the river and was surprised to see bright objects moving on it. I sat up and looked closer. It was a second party of canoeists, some half dozen of them. My goodness, I thought, this river is getting altogether too crowded. I need to get off it soon. The canoeists landed above the rapid on the side of the river I was camped on, evidently intending to scout out the white water. They hadn't seen my camp yet, so I lay quiet inside my tent, making notes in my journal. The proper thing to do was probably to have gone and introduced myself, but having just worked so hard to make my tent blackfly free, I really didn't wish to unzip the door and allow another invasion. At any rate, one of them, having spotted my camp, headed in my direction. "Hello," she announced as she approached. "Anyone home?" I thought for a moment, then said, "Hi," I added, from still inside my tent. "Sorry, since the bugs are bad, I'm just going to stay inside if you don't mind, but you can come over to the door, if you like." "Oh," she replied. "Yeah, they're awful." She swatted at the horde of black flies and mosquitoes swarming round her head as she approached. "How many of you are in there?" she asked. "Only one," I said. "Where's the rest of your party?"
"I'm it."
"Just you?" "My canoe, too."
"You're going solo down this river?"
She seemed surprised at the notion, as if traveling alone in the Arctic wilderness was strange or something.
"No," I said.
"Oh," she replied, nodding. "I'm going solo up this river."
"What?"
She crouched down to look through my screen door. She appeared to be about the same age as me. "I'm Adam, by the way," I said from inside. "Sorry, I don't mean to be unsocial. It's just that I've only just got my tent bug free and don't want more to come in."
"Oh, no worries. I understand. I'm Erica." She waved a hand.
"I thought for a second there you said you're going upriver." She laughed.
"I am."
Her eyebrows raised and her mouth opened, staring at me as if I'd said something crazy. After a moment, she seemed to realize I was serious.
"But how's that even possible?"
I briefly summarized my methods.
"Wow," she said slowly.
"That's kind of impressive, but also kind of insane." Then, evidently deeming me either an object of great curiosity or else not dangerous to the group, she called to the rest of her party to come over and join her. There were 5 of them, an all-women's group from a canoe camp in northern Minnesota. They'd been dropped by a float plane some weeks earlier on a lake, and now they were descending the copper mine to complete their trip. Erica was the camp leader. The others were younger. I told them about some nicer sights I'd seen farther downriver that they might make it to within an hour or so that were good for camping, with some nice beaches and a bit about what rapids they could expect. They seemed shocked when I spoke of the boundary waters in Minnesota, apparently having assumed I was some lone wanderer who must know nothing of the outside world, let alone anything of their home state. It seemed to reassure them that I wasn't as crazy as I first appeared. They wished me well, and I did the same for them, and 15 minutes after our conversation had begun, they left and continued downriver. Such extensive socializing had quite worn me out, and I half hoped that would be the last of it for at least another month or so. Chapter 14, Lakes Beyond Count.
Another hard day of battling rapids, some whose edges I could wade along, others so large I had no choice but to portage around them, brought me to the Coppermine River's outflow from a beautiful lake. I'd come to Rocknest Lake, a maze-like lake with a huge tabletop mountain overlooking it. To escape from the river's fury and be back on calm water was a great relief. I could paddle easily once more. I happily pulled off my waders, which had flooded again as I struggled in the current, and went barefoot in the canoe, my socks drying on the reef sail. It was somewhere on this lake that the pilot, Michael, had promised to drop off the remainder of my resupply. I wasn't sure of the precise location, but it was supposed to be on a remote island, easy to spot. Fortunately, the bush pilot was as good as his word. I found the stash without any trouble. No wolverines, bears, or Minnesotans had touched it. I decided to make camp on the little island my resupply crate was left on. It commanded a charming view of the wonderful surroundings, sparkling clear waters and big green hills, with granite cliffs and boulders scattered about the land as if by giants long ago. Even nicer was the island itself. Catching the sun as it did, the multitude of berries growing on it had ripened nicely.